Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We're going to listen to an interview and a presentation by Terrence McKenna on UFOs, aliens, and archetypes. Terrence McKenna was an ethnobotanist, a lecturer, and author. He was known as one of the leading authorities on the ontological foundations of shamanism and wrote about psychedelic drugs, metaphysics, alchemy, language, and the theoretical origins of human consciousness. I first discovered Terrence McKenna's work in 1995. I was helping a friend move a large china cabinet, and on the floor, behind this piece of furniture, was a white cassette. I asked my friend, "Can I listen to this?" She said, "Yes, take it." It was her mom's, and I said, "Thanks." I took it home, put it in the cassette player, and pressed play. It was one of Terrence McKenna's most psychedelic lectures, describing the DMT hallucinogenic landscapes of machine-like elves bouncing colored balls to each other. The presentation, however, we're about to listen to is from a 1990 television show called Thinking Aloud, hosted by Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove. Terrence McKenna is the guest, and it's titled Aliens and Archetypes. Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove currently serves as Dean of Transformational Psychology at the University of Philosophical Research. His newest book is called The PK Man, A True Story of Mind Over Matter. Let's go now to that interview with Terrence McKenna.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Throughout recorded history, human society has been haunted by reports of unidentified flying objects in our skies, many of which have defied all attempts at scientific explanation or understanding. What are these phenomena and how can they be explained? With me today is Terrence McKenna, a philosopher and thinker of note in the area of altered states of consciousness and alternative realities. Terrence is the co-author, with his brother Dennis, of The Invisible Landscape, and also Psilocybin, the Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide. He is a founding member of Botanical Dimensions, a nonprofit organization devoted to preserving and studying psychoactive plants used by native cultures throughout the world. And he is also the developer of a computer software package called TimeWave Zero, designed to augment interpretation of the ancient Chinese Book of Prophecy, the I Ching. Welcome, Terrence.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here with me also. You know, the UFO phenomenon is striking because it's so bizarre. It seems as if the reports that come in about UFOs defy any attempt whatsoever to categorize them. I guess from my point of view, I can only assume that there are probably many different interpretations of this event. I think, given your background as a student of shamanism and altered states of consciousness and alternative realities, you have some unique perspectives on the UFO phenomenon. I wonder if we could get into that material.
Yes, well, the ordinary approach to the UFOs has been to view them as visitors or intruders from a nearby star system that have come in metal ships for reasons of trade or scientific investigation or military conquest.
Or missionary activity.
Or missionary activity to the vicinity of our planet. And this was a myth that sprang up concomitant with the modern wave of sightings that began shortly after World War II. As time has passed and the number of sightings have gone from hundreds to thousands to hundreds of thousands of instances, as the myth has fleshed itself out with sub-themes, the theme of abduction, the theme of telepathic contact, it's become much more difficult to fit all the known facts into the simple model of spacefaring visitors from another world. So what we are left with then are a number of more exotic competing theories in the so-called postmodern phase of thinking about the UFO. Probably the best known of these alternative explanations was the one pioneered by the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung, who in 1953 wrote a book called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And Jung was at great pains to, without passing judgment on the reality of the saucers, of the things seen, to interpret them psychologically, to interpret them as one would interpret a dream. And he saw in their circular form, in their scintillating, shining, alchemical brilliance, a symbol of human wholeness, and felt that they were a symbol of our collective yearning for a kind of totality and individuation. Now, in a way, this kind of explanation is very satisfying. However, it is not satisfying to the person who has immediately undergone a very strange and a very real-seeming experience.
Unless such a person were told great messages of hope for the planet.
Well, and this is a persistent part of the flying saucer phenomenon, that people who have close contact with the saucers return with messages of universal brotherhood and benevolence, with stories of a beneficent hegemony of organized intelligence, where wiser, older worlds and civilizations help younger and less mature worlds toward a kind of galactic citizenship. However,
that's just one thread of the evidence.
It's one thread of the evidence, and it isn't really well supported by the evidence. Jacques Vallée, who is one of the foremost commentators on the phenomenon, has been at great pains to point out that with the flying saucer phenomenon, we're dealing with thousands and thousands of incidents per year throughout the world. It's very hard. With even at our own primitive level of scientific sophistication, we can learn a great deal about a planet by sending a single probe to that planet. What kind of scientific program of investigation requires thousands and thousands of appearances? And if we make the assumption that not all appearances are observed, but that in fact only a small number are observed, then the number of appearances that must actually be going on soars toward an astronomical number. It suggests we're dealing with an interpenetration by an alien dimension on an almost industrial scale.
Of course, a single probe could cause thousands of appearances.
If it were of a sophisticated enough nature, that's right. The approach that I have taken that has characterized my work with this phenomenon was, first of all, to say we have not carried out a sufficiently in-depth survey of the life already on this planet to be able to say that at some time in the past life did not arrive here and thrive here, that is not part of the general heritage of life on this planet, but that has somehow come in from the outside. My candidate for that kind of an intrusive extraterrestrial would be probably a mushroom of some sort, or a spore-bearing life form, because spores are very impervious to low temperatures and high radiation, the kind of environment met with in outer space.
In other words, a mushroom spore could conceivably waft itself up through the atmosphere of our planet and enter into empty space.
Oh, there's no question but what this is happening, that through what's called Brownian motion, which is sort of random percolation, spores do reach the outer edge of our atmosphere. And there, in the presence of cosmic rays and meteors and rare, highly energetic events, occasionally a very small percentage of these biological objects are wafted into space. We even possess meteorites that are believed to be pieces of the Martian surface thrown out by impacts on the Martian surface of asteroidal material. In fact, I think part of the grappling with the UFO mystery is going to lead to the conclusion that space is not an impermeable and insurmountable barrier to biology, that in fact planets are islands, and life does occasionally wash in from distant places, and if conditions are correct, can take hold. However, let me say, in the UFO phenomenon, we are dealing, or we presuppose that we are dealing, not simply with the phenomenon of extraterrestrial biology, But with the phenomenon of extraterrestrial intelligence, and this is a hackle-raising notion.
We're dealing with more than mushroom spores.
We're dealing with more than mushroom spores, at least as ordinarily conceived. And I think the thing that has been overlooked in almost all discussions of extraterrestrial contact is how strange the extraterrestrial is likely to be. It isn't going to be a friendly elfin little feller with a beating heart of gold. It isn't even going to be some of the more extravagantly grotesque creations out of Hollywood. Conditions and time spans in the universe are long enough and varied enough that I would bet that the real task with extraterrestrial intelligence will be to recognize it, you see. We have no conception of how species-bound our images of life and biology are. This is a place where we have never been asked to confront to what degree the monkey within us has channeled our expectations and perceptions.
Well, it is the case that on this planet, virtually all known life forms are based on the same DNA molecule.
Well, except that have all life forms been examined to see to what degree they deviate percentage-wise from, let's say, a standard DNA molecule? The answer is no. The sequencing of DNA is a very expensive process and is only carried out on laboratory organisms with an extensive history of involvement in medical research, like E. coli or the ordinary laboratory rat. No, there's a great deal we don't know about life on Earth. We don't know when the fungi entered into the evolutionary chain. We don't know what kind of intelligence is really possessed by the cephalopods, the shell-less mollusks that include the octopi. The intelligence of dolphins has been studied by Lilly and others. The intelligence of the large primates other than man. One way of looking at nature is that it is entirely linguistic intent, that DNA is in fact a way of uttering protein syntactical structures into matter.
In other words, it all of nature is like a poem.
Yes, nature is a communicating system of some sort. And the problem that we have is to transcend cultural languages, historically created languages with very limited applications, and instead fall into phase with the communication systems that nature has placed all around us. One possible view of the flying saucer is that it is a kind of projection from the consciousness of the planet, that it is Gaia, that it is in fact a kind of alchemical object haunting human historical time with a symbol of totality, the kind of totality that our religions and our mystical yearnings are so at pains to concretize for us. But unless we, as egocentric beings, clarify our relationship to the unconscious, then I think the flying saucer is going to remain quintessentially mysterious. And this was Jung's view.
One of the things that Jung pointed out in this book is that we must pay attention to the research which Dr. J.B. Rhein was doing at that time at Duke University in ESP and psychokinesis, and that even if UFOs had a physical reality, could be photographed or could be weighed and measured, that they still might in some manner be projections of the human mind.
Oh yes, this is an important point to make, which the flying saucer people are forever misunderstanding, and that is, saying that the flying saucer is a psychic object does not mean that it is not a physical object. Jung in Mysterium Conjunctionis is at great pains to say that the realm of the psychic and the realm of the physical meet in a strange kind of never-never land that we have yet to create the intellectual tools to explore. This is where the mystery of synchronicity is going to come to rest, the mystery of all kinds of paranormal activity on the part of human beings, and the mystery of the flying saucer. It's interesting, you see, that if you take the broad world of the so-called mysteries, parapsychological, shamanic, extraterrestrial, so forth, and hypothesize another spatial dimension, one more spatial dimension, then suddenly all these mysteries become trivial. Mm-hmm. They are easily done. Locked boxes are opened, future events are discerned, lost objects are found. This sort of thing becomes quite the ordinary run of things if we hypothesize dimensions hidden from ordinary experience.
And, of course, there's serious work at this point in the field of unified field theory and physics to postulate other dimensions of space than we normally think of.
So. That's right. The current mm-hmm. physical models of the universe require 11 dimensions, 11 integrated variables to describe. And that's physical models of mm-hmm. the universe. If we then turn our attention to mind and realize that having no definition of what mind is, why then is there any mystery in the fact that we have no definition of what the UFO is? The mind is present at hand in every conscious moment. It has been our constant companion for 50,000 years, and we haven't a clue as to what it is. So, therefore, a manifestation of the other, the superego, or the extraterrestrial other, like the UFO, it is not surprising that it is a mystery. I always hark back to the words of J.B.S. Haldane, the great British entomologist, who said, "Reality is not only stranger than we suppose, it may be stranger than we can suppose."
Well, that suggests to me that if we look at some of the most bizarre, most anomalous cases that we have, such as UFOs, and we begin to ask ourselves not so much what are they, because that's a mystery, but what is their function? How are they affecting us? That's like holding up a mirror to ourselves, and it tells us a great deal about the basic mystery of our mind and our
yes,
reality.
Yes, this is the so-called postmodern approach to ask the question, not what is the UFO, but what is it doing to us? And Jacques Vallée pioneered this approach, and the answer is fascinating. What the UFOs are doing to us, to global society, is they are eroding faith in science by casting directly in the path of science a kind of gauntlet, a challenge. Crack this. Almost as though the cosmic giggle had shown up at the bachelor party of science to spoil the bash. In the same way that the resurrection of Christ posed a tremendous problem for the intellectuals of late Roman antiquity, because they had no place in their worldview for someone rising from the dead. They were Greek materialists, atomists, essentially. In that same way, the UFO challenges the assumptions of science. And I think in that way, in that sense, Jung was really on to something when he saw it as coming from the unconscious. It is like an object coming from the unconscious with a compensatory function to turn us away from the rational and toward the intuitive, to turn us away from the paternalistic, Apollonian, solar, masculine view of things and toward a kind of watery, lunar, mysterious, intuitively felt feminine force, almost as though the UFO is a manifestation mm-hmm. of Gaia as mother goddess. Science as the proudest, pardon the word, erection of the rational mind, then is challenged by something from an entirely other dimension, an entirely other realm that concretizes for us the culture crisis. And that's why I've gotten into UFOs. I think they are important for a resolution of the culture crisis. They concretize the struggle between the paternalistic masculine and the lunar feminine to between a dominator society and the kind of partnership society that we require to survive.
And yet it seems as if that challenge is not a direct confrontation. It's, as Vallée points out, the UFOs are operating almost at the mythological level of our culture. They're not landing in the White House. They're not really challenging the military or NASA.
No, they're very mercurial, very watery. When you reach out toward them, there is nothing there. What they chiefly have become is an intellectual force in human thinking about the future. But when you reach out to grasp the hardware, to read the message, to meet the alien, there is nothing there. I've come to the conclusion, both from talking to contactees and having had a contactee experience, that whatever lies behind the UFO mystery, it is a force which can literally do anything. So it is fruitless to talk about the size of the objects or their composition or color or the size of the entities and their dress and weapons and accoutrements, because it can appear literally any way it wants to. It can appear as the Virgin Mary, it can appear as Galactarian overlords, it can appear as gnomes, elves, sprites, this sort of thing. It is not to be caught in the rational net.
No. Your description is strikingly actually parallel to the with one exception, to the view of many fundamentalist Christians who say this UFO stuff is all the work of the devil.
Well, I don't know about the work of the devil. Jung's criticism of Christianity was that it had not made a place for what he called the shadow. And he said the productions of Christian culture will always be neurotic because the shadow has not been included, so there's a lack of psychic balance. Perhaps the UFO carries compensatory psychic energy from the realm of the shadow. Some people are very frightened of it. Some people see it as an almost millenarian salvational hope, the savior of mankind. I think that it's very powerful, that it haunts time like a ghost, that the messianic anticipations of fundamentalist Christianity and Islam are in fact a picking up on the shockwave that the image of the flying saucer casts backward through time, that this image of the New Jerusalem, the four-gated city descending from the sky to whisk the elect away to a better place, is a kind of prophecy yearning toward a fact in the act of becoming. You know, Christianity and Islam are the most history-obsessed of all the world's major religions.
Along with Judaism.
Along with Judaism. And all three of them have this notion of the transcendental object at the end of time.
Yes.
And alchemy in the 16th century was an outbreak of an expectation of a transcendental object in the nearby here and now that would cure
the omega point of history.
Yes,
so to
that would cure all ills, confer longevity, fertility, virility, immortality. And I think that the flying saucer is an airborne philosopher's stone, the Sophic hydrolith of Paracelsus haunting the skies of modern America with a promise of mandalic cohesion for the future that science has not given us. Science has been a sadly disappointing religion in the realm of the heart. The flying saucer comes from the heart, but it bears the very strange energy of the other in its manifestation as planetary goddess.
Yeah. I'm often struck by the psychic powers that seem to be associated with people who have had intensive encounters with UFOs.
That's right. The thing
is, I've researched many of these cases myself.
It's both material and psychological. It anticipates the future. It seems as the memories of the contactees are transparent to this force. It can reach deep into their lives and confront them with information taken from forgotten incidents in their lives. It is an awesome kind of force that transcends space and time for the individual. Now, it may be that we will never have a general theory of flying saucers. It may be that this is something that addresses the individual in the same way that I don't think we will ever have a general theory of falling in love. That, too, is something which addresses the individual. We have been mistaken to expect Time magazine or the New York Times to explain the flying saucers to us. They will not explain the flying saucers to us any more than they will explain ourselves to us. This is something that haunts the membrane of experience very close in to the experiencing ego, and therefore it is threatening. And this is one of the reasons that I think it relates to the psychedelic experience, because the psychedelic experience is like a UFO encounter on demand.
Yeah.
It's where the will of the person having the experience enters in. They decide to have this curious, symmetry-breaking kind of experience. What I have tried to say to the UFO community is that we will not really have a deep understanding of what the contact experience is until we include data from the psychedelic experience as a legitimate data to be included when looking at the problem.
Yeah. Well, you have talked earlier about our need to make an extensive survey of all of the biological manifestations on our planet. It almost seems that in order to really get a handle on UFO phenomenon, we'd need to make a comparable survey of all of the psychological manifestations of which we are aware. And it seems to me that at some level, you would agree with me that the UFO phenomenon is one of our psychological manifestations.
Yes, I agree.
We've got about 2 minutes left, so I wonder if we can sort of summarize your view in that regard.
Yes, I think that the UFO phenomenon is a modern manifestation of a phenomenon which has been with us for thousands of years. That is the partial penetration of our own cultural space by others. Pixies, elves, fairies, sprites, demons, whatever you wish to call them.
Angels.
Angels. Mm-hmm. In the past, we had a professional class for dealing with these go-betweens. We called the professional class shamans, and they mitigated these comings and goings and had a lore and a mythology about them. As we have lost contact with our shamanic roots, the things which go on at a low frequency out in the wilderness and deserts of this planet have become to seem like us either like invasions from another world or virtual impossibilities. I think that the flying saucer is knocking on our door to remind us of the depth and strangeness and animate intelligence that is resident with us in nature on this planet.
Terence McKenna, it's been a very eloquent presentation, extremely thought-provoking. Thank you very much for being with me.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
That was an interview with Terence McKenna and Jeffrey Mishlove, titled Aliens and Archetypes, on the show Thinking Aloud. The next presentation by Terence McKenna is titled Shamanic Approaches to the UFO. The talk was given in November of 1987 at the Angels, Aliens, and Archetypes Conference in San Francisco, California. Terence elaborates on the idea that the skies of Earth are haunted by flying saucers as a response to the collective consciousness being mired in a current paradigm. In the Jungian model of perception is projection, the collective consciousness has prompted an auto-response by the archetypal feminine to the patriarchal, scientific, solar-based society. Let's have a listen.
Well, I'm aware of how late in the day it is, and I know some of you must be double parked, so I'll make this as succinct as possible. This morning's discussion caused me to wonder how much we would understand about electricity if our method of studying it was to stand on the tops of high hills and wait to be struck by lightning. It seems to me that's sort of the position that we're in vis-a-vis the UFOs. We have no real theory. We have conjectures. We have fiercely defended hypotheses, but we have very little that is concrete to go on. It's almost as though the issue of the UFO were an onion, and as we peel the layers of the onion, we discover when we get to the center that there is nothing there whatsoever left. It reminds me that if you cross an onion with a UFO, what you get is a flying saucer that brings tears to your eyes. And so what I would like to do is, just based on the notes I took today, to review what the options available to us are in terms of trying to get some kind of intellectual handle on this phenomenon, and I'll move through them rather quickly. One possibility that I suppose is now out of fashion because it wasn't mentioned here today, other than what Jacques said about ball lightning and plasmas, is that the UFOs are somehow natural phenomena, perhaps piezoelectric forces that have an ability to interact with the delicate electrochemical machinery of the human nervous system to create an impression of hallucination or visitation or abduction. That's one possibility. The more serious contenders as explanations, I think, fall into three categories. Is it us? Are we being visited? Or is there another tenant in the building that we are unaware of? And my own feeling about this tends to vacillate. I have had contact experiences. I have seen a UFO very close. I have met with entities from other dimensions, and it has not impelled me to take a strong position. I've paid very close attention when these experiences were happening to me, and there always seemed to be loose ends that argue against whatever hypothesis seems currently most attractive. And though Jacques didn't mention it today, I recall in his book, The Invisible College, he stressed the absurdity that seems to attend the contact experience, that if the contactee will truly tell the unvarnished truth, then there will be elements in the story which will make the contactee look like a moron. In other words, the invalidation of the experience is an inimical part of its structure, almost as though the entities were saying, well, you may tell this story if you wish, but if you tell it truthfully, you'll be taken for a fool. Well, there's nothing wrong with being taken for a fool, except that it does seal the phenomenon rather nicely away from the very sober ladies and gentlemen who are making their careers in some branch of science. They are not interested in investigating the kinky, the anecdotal, the possibly pathological. In preparation for this conference, I reread Carl Jung's book published in 1954 called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. And to my mind, no one has really gone beyond Jung. He understood very clearly that saying that something is a denizen of the psychic realm no way precludes its also having efficacious force in the physical realm through the phenomenon which he called synchronicity. Some of the points which Jacques made today about the nature of the medical examinations that are reported, they are absurd. They are unnecessary to be performed at our level of technology, let alone any future more advanced level that we might be asked to believe in. So if the UFO phenomenon is something that is coming from us, then what is it and what is it for? And I've given a good deal of thought to this question over the years because I tend to lean toward the notion that the UFO problem, like many subtle problems, is haunted by our own naivete concerning language. If I were to randomly choose, and don't worry, I shan't, five of you to come up here, and each one of you would have 40 seconds to explain to the rest of us what an atom is, it would be preposterous. None of us know. I doubt there's a person in this room who can give an account of the atom that tallies with the quote-unquote orthodox description of the atom. So there is a curious fuzziness about the most mundane parts of reality when we really attempt to magnify and understand them in the clear light of consciousness. How much more ambiguity there is then, naturally, attendant upon the examination of any kind of phenomena which are rare or tend to be fringy. So it isn't a matter of achieving consensus over the UFO. We can't even achieve consensus about what constitutes a decent souffle. So this passionate desire to drag us all under the umbrella of a single explanation is, I think, missing the point. To my mind, if the UFO phenomena is something arising out of the superego of the human psychic organization, then we should ask why. What is it doing? And I don't want to sound like a public relations agent for Jacques Vallée, but to my mind, with the exception of Jung, Jacques is the only commentator on the phenomenon who has really pushed the frontier back. To my mind, in The Invisible College, when Vallée says, in looking at the effect, not asking the question, what is it, but what does it do, you very quickly see what the flying saucers are doing. What they are doing is eroding faith in science. They are an antidote to the scientific paradigm that has evolved over the past 400 years and which has led us to the brink of global catastrophe. So the notion being developed here is that within the structure of the human psyche, there is something like a governor, something like a monitoring circuit, which when a society begins to evolve in a pathological or lethal direction, phenomena can be induced not by the egos of men and women, not by their institutions, but by the overmind, the collectivity of the human species. Phenomena can be induced which are so corrosive to the ideologies currently in place that their underpinnings are cut away, their validity is called into question, and their programs for social development and control are invalidated and destroyed. Now, a perfect example of this is the rise of infant Christianity. If you'll cast your mind back to the situation in the early years of the Christian era, and imagine the mentality of a Roman aristocrat, a person of power in Roman society. Their physics is drawn from Democritean atomism. In other words, they are thoroughgoing materialists. Their social theory is drawn from Epictetus and Plato. They are, in fact, extremely modern people by our own standards. However, among the gardeners and kitchen help and stable boys, there is news of a momentous event in the Middle East. A Jewish rabbi has triumphed over death and risen after 3 days in the tomb. Should the master of a Roman household have caught wind of this kind of superstitious talk among the help, he would have just dismissed it with a sneer. What a preposterous idea. And it is a preposterous idea. Nevertheless, the fact that an idea is preposterous has never held it back from making zealous converts. And within 120 years after the annunciation of the birth of Christianity, its missionaries were beating on the gates of Rome attempting to convert the emperor. Now, I see a similar situation in the modern context, that rationalism, scientific technology, which began and came out of the scholasticism of the Middle Ages and the quite legitimate wish to glorify God through an appreciation of his natural world, turned into a kind of demonic pact, a kind of descent into the underworld, a nekeia, if you will, leading to the present cultural and political impasse that involves massive stockpiles of atomic weapons, huge propagandized populations cut off from any knowledge of their real histories, male-dominated organizations plying their message of lethal destruction and inevitable historical advance. And into this situation comes suddenly an anomaly, something which cannot be explained. I believe that that is the purpose of the UFO, to inject uncertainty into the male-dominated, paternalistic, rational, solar myth under which we are suffering. So, I suppose if you had to categorize this point of view, you would say I'm taking a depth psychological, psychoanalytic point of view. What I'm saying is that the UFO is nothing more than an assertion of herself by the goddess into history, saying to science and paternalistically governed and driven organizations, you have gone far enough. We are going to turn the world upside down. Your science is going to be shown up for what it is, nothing more than a pleasant metaphor usefully extrapolated into the production of toys for healthy children. That's what science is good for. It is not some meta-theory at whose feet every point of view from astrology to acupressure to channeling need be laid to have the hand of science announce thumbs up or thumbs down. Now, there is another possibility which can be dovetailed into the first. It is that it is not so much the oversoul or the superego of the human species which is responsible for stopping scientific masculine paternalism in its tracks, but rather that, unbeknownst to self-absorbed and myopic human beings,
we have always shared, or at least for a very long period of time, have shared this planet with another intelligent species, another entity, which may have been perfectly content to allow us to abide in our ignorance of its presence until the point where it came to its awareness that our style was toxifying, ruining, raping, and perverting the planet. And at that point, this thing springs into action with similar end results as the previous scenario, the invocation of the superego. It's astonishing to me that in the 45 years that the UFO, are we being visited, question has been kicked around, I have never seen in any UFO book or publication the suggestion made that if we believe we are being visited by organic intelligent life forms from some other dimension or place in the galaxy, then we should very, very thoroughly examine the ecology of this planet for traces of its presence. What assurance do we have that the several million life forms that we know to exist on this planet all evolved here? Do we have any assurance? There are ways to gain that assurance by doing comparative DNA sequencing and this sort of thing. Some of you may know my own position, or one of my positions, which is that plants and fungi containing psychoactive compounds are extremely viable candidates for extraterrestrial intruders into the environment of this planet. And this is not to put down Whitley's story, which is a very interesting story, but had he prefaced his story with the comment that before it all happened, he took 5 grams of mushrooms, I doubt he could have sold it to his mother. Because in the world where mushrooms and other psychedelic plants are imbibed, such stories are commonplace. It's no big deal. So I'm always amused by UFO investigators and compilers of data who will tell you, well, the first thing we did is we got rid of all the stories told by anybody who was intoxicated on anything. It seems to me that move has probably absolutely precluded any possibility of understanding what is going on. You see, culture is something that we wear like clothes. We're very much at ease with culture. Our mind is very much at ease with culture. And we gather the language of a given culture around us. Culture is the mind unperturbed. When a shaman or an ecstatic visionary goes into the wilderness and through ordeal or yogic practice or breath control or the taking of a psychoactive substance perturbs the mind, then we see what the mind is out naked, undressed from the clothing of language and convention. That's why I've made this point over and over again. There will not be a serious discussion of the origin of UFOs, or for that matter, of the nature of consciousness itself, until we leave the utterly culture-bound, provincial, and hick-like attitude that science has foisted on us about perturbing the mind. Without the use of psychedelic substances, I think solving the UFO dilemma is going to be as thankless a task as attempting to understand the nature of the universe without availing yourself of the use of a telescope. It is simply tying our hands behind our backs. Now, there is a third possibility, which is the one that is the more commonly entertained notion, which is simply that we are being observed by intelligent life forms that evolved somewhere else in the galaxy. They have quarantined our planet to keep us from being agitated by their presence, and they will eventually reveal themselves. I find this an extremely odious notion, especially the part about how much chaos there will be if the truth is ever revealed. This is nothing more than the reassertion of masculine paternalism, its right to keep secrets from the rest of us, its belief that there is a privileged all-male class of people who can be let in on what's really going on, and the rest of us, poor dears, have to be shielded from these tremendously shocking facts. I discussed this once with an entity, and it said to me, well, you know, we've disguised ourselves as an extraterrestrial invasion so as to not alarm people with what's really going on. We're getting close to the end, folks. There is a fourth possibility, which I mention only in the interests of thoroughness, which is that these entities and their vehicles are not spacecraft at all, but are in some sense time craft, and that we may be the tremendous sense of empathy with these quite physically unusual beings may arise out of the fact that we're looking into the faces of our great-great-great-grandchildren who may be emanating back through time, carrying the message, a message, about some sort of future event or situation that lies many centuries downstream from us, but that is of such import that from that point, agents are moving backward and possibly forward through time, spreading the news of some kind of mode shift. This doesn't seem to me to be impossible. However, based on my own experience, which is what I think this thing really comes down to, because what we have in the UFO issue is an official position supported by scientists, whether they be Neanderthal right-wingers or doctrinaire Marxists or whatever, a conspiracy of consensus against the personal experiences of individual human beings, who are told, well, what you're saying happened to you can't have happened. You are insane, you are mentally ill, you are mistaken. So what we really have here is a political issue. Which do you believe? Your perceptions, memories, and expectations aided by your intellect, or some kind of utterly abstract, official, doctrinaire, sexist philosophy laid on from above? So I think really what the saucers do, if you accept their presence, is they empower us. They empower us to see science for the shell game that it is, to see the past 400 years of Western culture for the pathetic narrowing of the spectrum of allowable phenomena that it is, to the point where people think that if you can't bang on something with a hammer, it isn't real, which to me is just wild talk. I can't even imagine where that kind of thing is coming from. So I think, and I'll just leave you with this final thought, that in lieu of the repression, and it is a repression throughout this century, of legitimately available ways of exploring the modalities of consciousness, and by that I mean psychoactive compounds, the repression of those compounds and their use by science has created a neurotic energy dynamic in the mass psyche, and the mass psyche has begun to hallucinate because because the destiny of human beings is to live in the imagination in the hands of the goddess. And wherever that thrust is impeded, psychopathy will result. There will be neurosis. There will be psychic epidemic. There will be confusion. So I believe that until we form a resolution to conduct an unfettered and mature exploration of the human psychology using all the tools available to us, that the skies of Earth will continue to be haunted by flying saucers. They will continue to be haunted by flying saucers and their denizens, because they are symbols of our infantilism, of our sense of loss, of our incompleteness. And we can heal that breach by simply recognizing that the true mystery lies within us. The true mystery is in the mind, and its historical promise is the transformation of our society through the abandonment of reason as it has been narrowly defined by this extremely solar, masculine, paternalistic, materialistic legacy that we are the victims of. Well, I could talk for a long time, but I think that's it in a nutshell. Thank you. Thank you.
That was a presentation by Terrence McKenna titled Shamanic Approaches to the UFO. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for more information and archive shows.